Hello everyone and welcome along to another podcast of Clarabelle in Conversation with me, Claire Ford, and RNIB Connect Radio. Today on the podcast, I am joined by Rachel Walker, otherwise known as Ray. Ray's story is truly inspirational. She's a beautiful young woman with hair that changes colour with her mood. She sports a couple of tattoos, she's very feisty and outspoken, and is a fierce competitor in her chosen sports of running and swimming. And she has just recently taken up another less conventional way of keeping fit, one that is generally more associated with lap dancing clubs rather than running tracks or swimming pools. Ray's primary medical condition, juvenile arthritis, led to her ultimately losing her sight completely at the tender age of 22, over 3 years ago. And she is someone that I'm proud to call one of my friends. Hello, Ray, and welcome to Clarabelle in Conversation. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, doing well, thanks. Especially in these strange circumstances, it's fantastic that you've agreed to appear on the podcast today. And for everyone at home who's listening, whether you're a first-time listener or whether you've listened before, I hope you enjoy yourself and that you have fun like we're about to do right now. Ray, as I mentioned in my introduction, you lost your sight completely at the age of 22 over 3 years ago. But when you were born, the doctors didn't notice any medical issues with you whatsoever. Can you tell us a bit about your sight loss journey from when you were a baby and how you came to lose your sight?
Well, as you were saying, Claire, when I was born, there was nothing wrong with me. I was a healthy, average baby. And it wasn't about until, say, maybe a year and a half, my parents started to notice problems. I should have been starting to walk, but I wasn't. And my dad was changing me. Maybe pulled in my leg just a little bit, and I started to scream. So something was wrong there. Took me to the hospital, found out I had juvenile arthritis. I got steroid injections in my leg for it, and everything was fine. I haven't had any problem with my arthritis ever since. However, the downfall to that was the arthritis might come back worse, or I would have other medical problems, and it happened to be the other medical problems that happened. So I ended up developing a disease called Still's disease. I'm not too sure how that developed into the current disease I've got now, which is called uveitis, which in actuality I never knew until recently has nothing to do with the eyes. It's an immune disease, which basically means my immune system is overactive and it is bored and it's looking for things to do. So it's decided to reject certain organs in my body. And it just so happened to reject my eyes, which caused a whole number of medical problems like inflammation, glaucoma, bankeratopathy. I won't say all these big words because a lot of people might not know what they are, but a whole host of problems. And that's how it all started. I had numerous surgeries when I was younger, and I'd say probably in my teenage years, things started to calm down a bit. I didn't have as many surgeries. And it was 3 years ago. It had been a long time since anything significant with my eyes had happened. And I was getting to the stage where I wanted to get surgery that would maybe resurrect some of the sight I had back. So I've had my cataracts removed, but they left a ledge in my eye to put plastic ones in later, things like that. But the doctor wasn't too keen in doing any of these kind of surgeries because they said that my hormones still hadn't settled, which I thought was, you know, a bit shocking at the age of 22. But apparently your hormones don't settle till you're 30, which I never knew. But I pushed and pushed and pushed, and I said to the doctor, you know, just give me a trial period. I'll stop taking my tablets. I hardly take them anyway, which was a bit naughty of me. So he gave in. I stopped taking my tablets. I was actually down in London at the time, and I was outside in the garden journaling, and I noticed that I couldn't see the lines very well. And I walked into a lamppost at one point, but I just kind of put it down to I never even clocked with the lamppost, but the lines in my journal, I just put it down to, oh, I'm not taking my tablets. I'll go home, start taking them again. Things will go back to normal. And it didn't. So went to the doctors and they could see anything wrong, but they weren't denying the fact that my vision had dropped. Went back 2 weeks later, and then that's when they discovered that my retina had detached. So that was in May 2017, and they really didn't want to do surgery to reattach the retina because of all my existing medical problems. My eye was so fragile that they were too scared that it would cause more grief than it would fixing things. So they tried to do other things like freezing the peripheral of my retina. Things really worked. So after, I think, maybe like one surgery and some sort of funky laser treatment, they finally decided, right, we're going to have to do the retina attachment surgery. And yeah, got that done in August 2017, and they weren't sure if doing it would bring back my sight or not bring back my sight, because they'd never done it in somebody like me before. And you know, 3 years on, I'm still as blind as I was then, so it probably didn't work, but what are you going to do?
Oh, it definitely is. It's a hard thing to have to go through. And during that time, you described that waiting period as being in limbo. Can you explain to us about the floods of emotions that you experienced at that time?
Well, it's kind of like, I think when somebody passes away, they talk about like the five stages of grief. It was kind of like that. So when I first got told about it, one of the doctors didn't have very good bedside manners, so he left me kind of feeling as if there was nothing they could do and I was just going to go blind and that was it. So for the first maybe 2 weeks, I was pretty down in the dumps. If it wasn't for my mum forcing me out of my bed, I might have been in a worse state. So thanks for her helping me through that. Pretty much every night I would go to bed and I'd just be like, look, I'll go to bed and I'll wake up and my sight will be magically back. You know, I was in denial. I was in denial for a very long time. I kept saying to myself, look, I don't have to deal with this for too long. I'll have my surgery, I'll have my treatment, things will go back to normal. I don't have to learn how to use JAWS. I don't have to learn how to use voiceover. It's just temporary. It's, yeah, I'm not doing it. I'm not, you know. And even when I got my big surgery, the one in August, I was still like, you know, and this will be fine. It'll probably take a month or so to heal. It's a big surgery, but I don't have to learn anything. And so it did take me a very, very, very long time to come to grips with, this is your new normal and you're going to have to deal with it. And to this day, you know, 3 years on, I'm a lot, you know, better equipped. You know, I wake up every morning and I'm like, yeah, this is it, this is my new normal. But there is some days 3 years on when I'm still kind of like, oh, I don't like this. And I don't know if that'll ever change, but it's just about accepting it within yourself. And it does take a long time, and everybody will go through things quicker or slower. Everybody's different in how they react to things. Most of my going through limbo was just denial and then trying to come to terms that this could be my new.
And what impact did that have on your family when you were given the news that you were now registered blind?
It sounds really selfish, but I can't actually really remember because I was so in my own wee bubble. I think my mum was really upset. I think she was just really upset because there was nothing she could do, and to see me just acting so defeated. My dad was probably the same, but I can't really remember. I think everyone else was a bit in shock also, to the point where I think everybody else was just kind of like, oh, she's just having a bad time, it's fine, she'll get these surgeries, she'll get these treatments and everything will be fine. So I think it was like, you know, denial and then a gradual acceptance period for everyone.
And as someone who lost their sight at 18 overnight, I can totally empathise with all these feelings that you were feeling at that time. Going back to when you were a baby, as I said, you started developing sight problems roughly about the age of three. Do you feel that you received support when your sight was becoming more of an issue as a child?
I think so. When I was younger, I was visually impaired, but I was only like slightly visually impaired. It sometimes boggles my mind thinking about the stuff that I could see when I was younger versus the stuff I could see 5 years ago. So I did go to a mainstream school, and I was okay. It wasn't until maybe about primary five or six, teachers from schools that had a visual impairment unit came out and gave me like cameras and other types of equipment to help me out. But it wasn't till probably halfway through primary six when my sight started to become more of a problem that it was considered maybe I have to move primary schools to a primary school that can better help me. It was my decision. I remember getting taken into the headmistress office and being asked, do you want to move schools? And me being the slightly stupid 11-year-old, I was like, oh yeah, it's an adventure, it'll be fun, and not thinking I'm gonna miss all my friends. So yeah, I did go to a primary school halfway through six and primary seven that had a visual impairment unit. It was a Now Talk Primary, and they helped me a lot. They were really good. And then I went to Uddingston Grammar, which was a high school that had a visual impairment unit, and they helped me the best I could. And I say that because yes, they helped me the best they could visual impairment wise, but maybe not in other fields.
That's really interesting. And in terms of losing your sight at 22, you've spoken on many occasions about how Haggai, the RNIB's fantastic youth forum here in Scotland, was instrumental in what you described as your rehabilitation after you lost your sight. In what ways did Haggai assist you to become more independent, confident, and regain your desire to get out there into the world and enjoy life?
They gave me a reason to do something. I have to go out to meet because I want to see my friends. But you know, before I made friends, it wasn't I want to see my friends, it was more because this will be good for me. I'm going to meet other people that have got visual impairment problems, and I can learn some things from people that have been experienced with visual impairment for years, and then people in the same situation as me. I thought this will be good, and it's the kick up the backside I need. And because of that, it was, you know, going there, and I would hear people that previously were in my situation couldn't leave the house without somebody, and then all of a sudden are like hopping on a plane to America completely themselves, which to this day, that still terrifies me, going on a plane myself. But and I thought, you know, it's you get that idea in your head, it's like, well, if they can do it, why can't I do it? And it's like, okay, they can see a lot better than I can, but it doesn't mean I can't try, because I'm pretty sure there's other blind people out there that do it. And if I try and I know I can't do it because my sight's limiting me, then I'll keep trying to find other ways to do it, you know. So it just gave me that motivation. And with that motivation, I got the train myself through people from Haggai. I learned about train assistance, and that was huge for me, because back when I was visually impaired, I didn't take any help from anyone. I was horrifically stubborn. I was just like, nope. And if I'd known about assistance on the train, then I could have gotten two trains, you know, changing trains. That's something I never would have done, whereas now, I don't know about the journey. The journey would probably put me off. But if somebody said to me, you have to change trains three times, I'd be like, no bother whatsoever, because I don't have to worry about it. I have someone else to take me like the princess I am.
I know, I can totally empathise with the stubbornness. I'm exactly the same. And I can totally vouch for the amazing work that Haggai does as a fellow Haggai member myself. And Haggai, for anyone who doesn't know, caters for children and young people here in Scotland from the ages of 12 to 25. Would you recommend Haggai to anyone who wants to make friends and make the most of the support that's on offer to them?
Yeah, it's really good, even if you don't want to go along. If politics or campaigning isn't really your thing, which wasn't really mine, just go along to talk to some of the people to just, you know, hear about things that you're entitled to, like train assistance and the C card, which means that you and the person you're with, your carer, you know, you get a discount, you know, all that kind of stuff. I would never have known anything if I hadn't met a bunch of people with visual impairment problems. And where else would you meet a bunch of people with visual impairment problems other than a group like RNIB and Haggai?
Hear, hear, totally agree. And as I've experienced myself, Ray, there comes a point in your sight loss journey where you decide it's time to dust yourself down and get out there into the world and live life to the full. Now, for you, this started with running. Can you explain why you decided that running would be a great way to reconnect with the outside world?
It was actually a really weird way that it started. So I think I was out shopping with my mum, and I just kind of felt really, I can't think of the right words, just like I just felt tired all the time and I didn't know what to do about it. So why don't you try running in the treadmill in the house? And I thought that's a great idea because, you know, it's stationary, I can hold on to the handles. And at the time I wasn't doing anything, I wasn't at uni or I didn't have a job. So it just kind of started off like, I just want to have a reason to get out of bed, feel a bit healthier, feel like I've got a purpose in life. And then it kind of turned into a game. It was kind of like, oh, cool, I ran a mile, I'm exhausted, but that's a mile. I've never been able to do that. Let's see if I can like build up to 2 miles. And then the next thing I had it, I was signing up for doing half marathons.
And can you tell us a wee bit more about the logistics of getting out to run when you're blind or partially sighted? And what assistance do we as blind and partially sighted people require to enable us to do this as an activity?
I was very lucky. I know for a blind and visually impaired people to go outside running to find a guide runner, which is basically somebody that runs with you. You can either be connected by a tether, which is a piece of rope that goes around their wrist and your wrist, or you can just hold the person's arm. If I'm running in a quite rough terrain, I prefer to hold the person's arm for just a bit of security. But I was really fortunate enough that my guide runner lives just down the bottom of the road from me. I met him at the train station and we just ended up getting talking, and I realised that he was a member of a running club and he's actually done courses in guide running. And he said to me, if you ever want to go out running or join the club, which I said to him, I definitely would. But at the time I wasn't fit enough running to do that. At the time, the most I could probably do was about 3, maybe 4 at a push. So I said to him, you know, when I get to that level, I'll definitely consider it. And I did. And I was really lucky. Really being grateful I was that I had my guide runner just down the bottom of the road, because I know some people have to go on websites or apps to actually find guide runner. As well, there's hundreds of guide runners out there looking for blind people to run with. And apparently there's like more guide runners than there is blind runners, which I find like mind boggling. But I was really lucky.
And running is a great way of being able to get out and socialise with people, to keep fit and in shape, but most importantly, to ensure that we are healthy in both mind and body. Do you feel that your mental health and overall outlook on life, Ray, has improved any since taking up running as a sport?
Yes, it's like I said, it made me feel as if I had a purpose. It made me feel as if I was doing something with my life. And, you know, to say something miles, you know, it's a great feeling. And the endorphins that you get from running, it is a known thing. You get runner's endorphins. I usually get them about 3 miles in. And it's just the best feeling in the world. It's like being drunk, but you're not. You're just running down the road, singing at the top of your lungs. And it is great. And it's a I do recommend it to anyone, even if it's not running, even walking, just being out in nature, hearing the birds or hearing people out of their cars. It just, it's the fresh air does you good.
Fantastic. And back now in November 2017, a friend of yours invited you along to a vision impairment sports day. And it was at this sports day that your love of running and other sports really took off. Can you tell us about some of your accomplishments that you've achieved in running so far, Ray?
To date, I have done, let me think, I have done two half marathons, which is the Glasgow half marathon and the Edinburgh half marathon. I was supposed to be doing my first marathon this year, but due to COVID, it was obviously cancelled. Hopefully I'll get to do it next year, but we'll see how things go.
That's fantastic. And I believe that it was our friend Jill Hendry and fellow Hag Eye member who introduced you to swimming as a sport that you would thrive in.
Yes. She admired me to do it because I just seen how good she was at it and was really into running. So I think having all these friends from Hag Eye who were so into sport kind of gave me the motivation, you know, oh, if they're doing it, I can do it. So it was a little bit competitive because I am a bit competitive, like, oh, she's swimming, I can swim too. So it was really good.
After the VI sports day, after you attended it, that after that you began to compete in swimming competitions quite regularly. Can you tell us about some of the adventures you've had in the pool, Ray?
Well, if you like swimming into walls and getting tangled up in lane ropes, then yeah, swimming blind is definitely an adventure. I have noticed in competitions, the faster I swim, the straighter I swim, but I don't know if it's something I'll ever be able to do is swim straight. So I have had my fair amount of bruises, but that is to be expected in sport. You know, don't do sport if you don't want to get some minor bumps and grazes along the way. Funnily enough, everybody always says to me about diving, they always say, do you not find that terrifying? You're just going head first into something you can't see. And I do a little bit, but I guess I don't really overthink it. I just do it because I think I have the whole mindset of there's just water underneath me and it can't really do me any harm. I've never been scared of the water or anything like that, so I don't have any of those fears. Even if I died really, really, really low, I can hold my breath for quite a long time, so that's never really fazed me. Tumble turns, I'm still getting used to them. Again, a lot of people say to me, do they not terrify you? You can't see the wall and you're coming up to the wall and you have to do a tumble turn. Are you not scared that you'll bang your head off the wall? Thankfully, my swimming instructor is amazing. I don't know how she does it, but she has a skill. So when I'm swimming, I have a tapper. I think you can like buy professional ones online, but she just made it and it does the job. So when I'm coming up to the wall, she just taps me in the head to let me know to stop. I only really need tapped with front crawl and back crawl with a breaststroke. For some reason, the way my arms are positioned, I kind of feel the wall before my head does, if that makes sense. But she has this uncanny ability that she knows when to tap me that I'm the perfect distance away from the wall. So I'm not so far away that when I do my tumble turn, I have nothing to push off of. But I'm not so close to it that I'm going to be ripping my back, banging my head off it. So it's all thanks to her. You know, teamwork, that's what it's all about in swimming.
I really, really admire your bravery, in particular with diving. I personally wouldn't even attempt diving when I had sight, let alone now that I've not got sight. I wouldn't even dream of doing it at all. So I admire your bravery there. And what advice would you give to anyone who's blind or partially sighted who wants to take up swimming as a sport?
just so you know, find out where your local disabled swimming club is. Talk to the instructor if you have any worries or fears. Let them know, and they'll, you know, talk you through if your swimming instructor's anything like mine, which they would be, hopefully. You know, they're not going to force you to do things you don't want to do. So if you don't want to do diving, you don't want to do tumble tons, because quite a lot of people at my club don't do it because they don't want to do it, and that's totally fine. You know, it's about the swimming, it's not about the added extras. But don't overthink it. If you do want to dive and you're scared, try not to think about all the bad can happen, just do it. And if you clog your head off the sides, it'll hurt, but again, try not to overthink it. Just take a couple of minutes to get a breather, make sure your head's still on, and then go again.
Such a great attitude to have in particular with that. And we touched on it a wee bit earlier, but one of your big achievements that you've achieved over the last 3.5 years since going completely blind, Ray, was the fact that you've competed in so many half marathons. As you mentioned yourself, you were about to take part in your first full marathon in Liverpool. But can you tell us a wee bit about the impact that the event being cancelled had on you mentally and physically after training so hard and getting into shape for the race?
Well, thankfully, my marathon was, when was it supposed to be? I think it was supposed to be in May. So I officially started my training in February, serves me right. But the way marathon training works is it is a build-up. So you start off doing maybe about 5 miles, or sometimes the training plan even says lower than that, but I'm just like, no, I'll start at 5. And you work your way up till you get to the peak, which is usually about 20 miles, because when you're doing a marathon, you never run the full distance. You save that for the actual marathon, and then you come back down again. If COVID had really taken off, I'd say in the middle of April, that's when I'd be in the heat of my training, I would have been a lot more upset. But because COVID happened when it did, I was only, I think the furthest distance I'd actually done was about maybe 10, 11 miles outside. So I was, you know, I was definitely getting into the bigger miles, but I wasn't into the scary, scary miles yet. So I was upset. I was, but at the same time, the way I looked at it was, well, this training you've done isn't for a waste of time. You've had practice with your guide runner outside. You've exercised, you've got fresh air, you've had fun, and you're still keeping your fitness levels up, so it's not a complete waste of time, and you can try again next year.
Yeah, absolutely, that's the right way to look at it. And on the subject of COVID-19, how has the lockdown and the restrictions that you've been living under over the last couple of months affected you in terms of sport and in life in general?
Oh, rubbish. In terms of sport, not great. I haven't swam in what feels like 100 years, I think. When we were allowed to go back to swimming with a club, I got to go for one night, and it was amazing. It was great. I thought I was going to go because I hadn't swam in about, I mean, I think that was September, so I hadn't swam in about 6 or so months. I thought, I'm going to be knackered. I wasn't. I was thrilled. I was like, I don't know how. I'm not tired. I managed to like beat my record of how many lengths I've swam in an hour. I'm like, I don't know how I've done that since I haven't swam in goodness knows how long. And then I was gutted to find out, you know, that weekend, because of the new restrictions, anyone over the age of 18 wasn't allowed to go back. And, you know, I've just been really upset about it, because the under 18s could still go, but the over 18s couldn't. And I think particularly, you know, if you've got a disability, things are harder, because my swimming instructor did say to me, I can still go swimming off my own accord and other, you know, swimming centres that they've got lane swimming and what have you. But after a whole load of phone calls and a whole load of headaches, I found out that I wasn't allowed to just have a lane to myself with one other person. I'd have to share a lane with like seven other people, which is madness. You know, it comes to the thing, it's like, okay, so I'm at a swimming club and I'm not allowed to swim at a swimming club, would I be in my own lane? But when you're not in a swimming club, you can swim in a lane with eight other people. I don't know how that's social distancing, but, you know, I don't understand the rules. It frustrated me to no avail. Running, I've still been doing it myself in the house. I was doing it for a while outside with my guide runner, but I did lose a little bit of heart, a little bit of motivation, because it was kind of like, why am I running? I've got nothing to train for. I've got nothing to practice with. And I'm still doing it. It just sounds bad. I guess I couldn't be bothered socialising with people. And I feel that's how what lockdown, I'd rather just be in my own room and not talk to anyone, which is really unhealthy. And I'm trying to break out of it. But because we're supposed to social distance and isolate, I feel like a lot of people are feeling that way and ending up going that way.
I know it's not been easy for any of us, and the good thing about it is that we're all in the same boat and we're all, you know, kind of trying to overcome things, in particular during the lockdown. And in addition to the more conventional ways of keeping fit, as I touched on in the introduction, you have taken up a less orthodox way, pole fitness. Does this signify a career change for you, or is this just a fun way of keeping fit?
Oh, if I could get a career out of it, I would. But unfortunately, a blind pole dancer already exists, that she's won several awards. So unfortunately, I can't stand here and say I am the only blind pole dancer in the whole world, you know. But yeah, it's the same with pole as well. I tend to just call it pole, not pole dancing. I'll call it pole dancing for people that might not be familiar with the term pole, just because a lot of people seem to think when I say pole dancing that yeah, as you said in your introduction, that it's something strippers do. And I can guarantee you all my clothes stay on.
And is everyone listening to the podcast, it's probably sussed out, Ray, you have boundless energy, not just for the sports that you do, but for education. You're currently studying a degree in social sciences and psychology at the Open University with the aim of going to university to study social work and then become a social worker. How has your studies impacted you as a result of being blind?
Well, I've actually finished my Open University courses now, so that's been okay. When I first started it, the reason why I went for Open University was because I was unsure of whether or not I'd be able to do it, whether or not it'd be too much for me. And I was a little scared doing it all online, still not being as savvy with JAWS as I possibly would like. But, I started it, and it's kind of like muscle memory. Once you kind of know the layout of the website and where you're going and what you're doing, it becomes really easy, especially if you're doing it every single day, which is what I try and remind myself every time I do something new. Like if I'm out walking and I'm doing a new route, I always say it's really difficult just now and it's taking up all my energy. But when I keep doing it, there'll come a point where I'll be able to do it and I won't even have to, you know, think twice. It'll just become second nature. So the courses were really good. I had classes, face-to-face classes, once every month, maybe once every 5 weeks, which were really nice to meet people from my course. And it was a nice excuse to get out and about and not just be stuck in the house on your laptop. But I did quite like the idea that it was on my laptop. So when COVID came along, it didn't affect me too much because it was already in the house studying on my own. It just meant that my face-to-face classes were no more. So I'm just really thankful that I finished my course in May. Actually, no, it was April. I was supposed to have an exam in May and it got cancelled because of COVID. So I'm just glad that I finished everything right as things were getting a bit chaotic. And in terms of going to uni to do social work, unfortunately, I wasn't successful with that. Apparently, social work is one of the most difficult courses to get into because it's vocational. And in a strange way, I'm kind of glad I didn't get in with everything that's happening right now. Open University is designed to be studying online, but from what I've heard from my other sighted friends that have been studying mainly online that would have went to classes in uni before, apparently it's really difficult and not great, and the communication's not where it should be. So in a strange way, I'm kind of happy I didn't go to uni this year.
And definitely it's I think just this pandemic, I think in some ways it's made us think about things as well, in addition to you know all the happy things that go on, just maybe focusing on the silver lining to the difficult things that go on as well. So I'm glad that you actually have managed to cope with that and have managed to accept that. In addition, on a lighter note to all the other things that you do, you also have a YouTube channel, a fantastic YouTube channel, Charlotte, called Blue Clouds. Can you tell us a wee bit about that?
Yeah, it's a YouTube channel I have, and I just kind of film my life, really. So I have it at an angle of, you know, I'm a blind girl or woman, however you want to look at it, that lives her life just like anyone else would that wouldn't have a disability. And this is how I go about it, because I'm aware that because I have a disability, I don't do things the same as other people do. So it's kind of like, okay, I can write a Christmas card with pens and stickers, and, you know, I can jazz it up, and a lot of people will be like, oh, how do you do that? So I kind of have videos to display, you know, just because you're blind doesn't mean you still can't write with a pen and paper in a book. Yeah, your writing might be a bit wonky and a bit illegible at times, but you can still do it. And even though you can't read it back, it's still the thought that counts, giving it to somebody. It can really brighten up somebody's day. And yeah, it's just basically just showing sighted people, but also people with visual impairment and blind, that you can do nearly everything a sighted person could do, minus the fact I don't think I'd want to perform open heart surgery or be a pilot.
I don't think many people would want to do that. I think you need to be really brave to do these things anyway, so, you know, it's less the battle anyway. Professor John Hill wrote two seminal works. He lost his sight completely at age 45, and he wrote two seminal works on losing his sight, Notes on Blindness and Touching the Rock. He famously said in one of his seminal works, "It's a gift, not a gift I want, but it's a gift." You famously said that you losing your sight was the best thing to ever happen to you. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
It's made me a better person inside and out. So when I had my sight, I think it was the fear. Well, I say sight, when I was visually impaired, I could still see people. I overthought everything, you know. I didn't want to talk to people or do anything because I was scared of the reaction. And I think being able to see them made me, having sight made me scared to do things that I wouldn't usually do. But now that I don't have sight, it's kind of like, right, I'm going to go up to that person and talk to that person. And even if that person pulls a face, or I won't be able to see it anyway. So, you know, ignorance is bliss, as the saying goes. And it just gives you that confidence. You can't see how people react to you. So if I was walking down Buchanan Street with my camera out talking to it, I can guarantee you there'd be a few people staring at me. And I know that. But when you can't see it, you're less aware of it. So your confidence levels aren't affected. And I think that has been the case. I'm a lot more confident. I'm a lot more confident asking for help as well. Being blind, if I'm out and about, it's not a secret. People can see my cane, and I'm not afraid to say to people, yeah, I'm blind and I can't do this. Can you do it for me? Whereas before, when I had some sight, I felt really awkward about it because a lot of people don't know there's a whole spectrum in between. And it's a case of, oh, I can't see very well. Can you tell me where the bathroom is? And then you get the whole pointing a finger, oh, it's over there. And I'd be like, oh, okay. Wait till the person walked off, but still standing there thinking, I have no idea where they pointed to, and I have no idea where over there is, and too shy to actually be like, okay, can you physically take me? Because I can't see. So it's little things like that. Just, you know, the whole mindset of, you know what? I don't want to say the worst has happened to me, because so many more bad things could have happened. I'm really grateful that I've still got my health. But with losing my sight, it's kind of been like, okay, it's all gone. It's completely gone. I don't have anything to worry about. It's a relief. So just go in with both guns firing, because why not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And in terms of the blind and partially sighted thing, I mean, I definitely find that myself. Partially sighted people don't really understand. Whereas if you say, I'm blind, they'll go, oh, right, okay, here we go, and they understand it. And especially if you have a guide dog or anything like that, I've noticed that myself. And this attitude that you've got, this, you know, carefree attitude, has resulted in you changing your hair colour so many times. You've got tattoos, a dog paw tattoo, a seahorse tattoo, and you've also got several piercings. Why do you decide to show these parts of your personality off to the world, Ray, if you can't see them yourself?
I like them, and I've always liked them. Even when I had sight, I liked them. And it's also a lot of people, not everyone, but some people have this whole stereotype of blind people not caring. It is the case of, you know, if you can't see what you look like, then why bother? Not see my hair colour, but I know they're there and I can imagine them in my head, and just having that image in my head makes me act differently in a way. It's psychology. I was reading the other day there that depending on what colour your hair is, you can act differently psychology wise, and it is really interesting. So it just goes to show you that you don't have to see it. You can feel good inside just knowing that, you know, you're wearing a full face of makeup, you're wearing a lovely dress, your hair's all curled, and to, you know, skip about and be like, look at me, I feel awesome. And people should thinking about, oh, I can't see, so what's the point of having it? But if you know it's there, it's just the same way. It's just you feel the same way.
That's amazing. I mean, you hear about mood rings that people wear, and with the mood that you're in or whatever you're feeling at that time, the colour of your ring changes colour. I mean, I didn't realise that about hair as well. So that's absolutely fascinating. I didn't know that. Definitely something to read up on myself. Ray Walker, YouTube vlogger, independent, confident, strong woman, just happens to be blind, and a general jack of all trades. It's been a pleasure to speak to you today on Clarabelle in Conversation.
Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure to talk to you.